From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Boorman directed the films Deliverance, Point Blank, and Hope and Glory. On today's Fresh Air, Boorman tells us about his new movie, The General, based on the life of the notorious Irish thief Martin Cahill. One of Cahill's victims in the 1980s was John Boorman. We'll also meet one of the stars of The General, John Voight. He plays the Irish police inspector determined to capture the elusive criminal. Voight first worked with John Boorman on the 1972 film Deliverance. Voight is also co-starring now in Enemy of the State. John Boorman and John Voight coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Six states inaugurated governors today. Jesse Ventura was sworn in as the governor of Minnesota. The former professional wrestler and suburban mayor is the first Reform Party candidate elected to a statewide office. He said his campaign gained the support of young and disaffected voters and said it's important to keep that generation engaged in the political process. Ventura said he's certain to make mistakes as governor, but he promised to do his best for the people of Minnesota. Democrat Gray Davis was sworn in as California's governor. From member station KXJZ in Sacramento, Bill Rickman reports.
Gray Davis has served 24 years in California state government. Now he is the governor, the first Democratic governor in 16 years. In his inaugural speech, Davis promised to govern from the middle and to make California's schools his first priority. He describes himself as a pragmatist and a problem solver, says he does not feel obligated to a rigid ideology, but he has already served notice that on such hot-button issues as affirmative action and state services for illegal immigrants, his policies will be much more liberal than his Republican predecessors. Davis is the only Democratic governor of a large state. Suddenly, the longtime state politician is a major force in national politics. For NPR News, this is Bill Rickman in Sacramento.
Three members of a Christian sect based in Denver, Colorado, face criminal charges in Israel. 11 more have been ordered deported in connection with an alleged doomsday plot. Steve McNally reports from Jerusalem.
The three sect members will appear before a magistrate on suspicion that they plan to provoke a shootout at Jerusalem's Temple Mount. They apparently believe that by doing so, where Christ is prophesied to be resurrected in the millennium, they could hasten the second coming. 14 sect members were arrested last night at homes they rented near Jerusalem several months ago. The Interior Ministry has ordered the remaining 5 adults and 6 children deported back to the U.S. They have 72 hours to appeal. No weapons had been seized from their homes. Police believe they were the first wave of sect members who disappeared from their homes in Denver last fall and were reported headed for Jerusalem. They were arrested by a new Israeli task force created to deal with an expected influx of extremists for the millennium. For NPR News, this is Steve McNally in Jerusalem.
The Clinton administration is preparing to announce a slight easing of the embargo against Cuba. A senior administration official told reporters today that the president will expand people-to-people contacts with Cuba and make it easier to send food and money to the island. The official, who declined to be identified, said the object is to help the Cuban people, not to support the Castro government. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to end the day at 9,184. Advances led declines by a 4-3 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Iraq has told the United Nations that it cannot guarantee the safety of American and British citizens working on humanitarian projects. The Iraqi government has previously said that Americans and Britons on the UN weapons inspection teams were spies and demanded that they be removed. The UN has refused to do that, saying Baghdad can't dictate the nationalities of the people on UN teams. Iraq hasn't specifically threatened to expel the British or American aid workers, but foreign ministry officials have reportedly told the UN they wanted some people to leave the country. Incoming House Speaker Dennis Hastert says the new Congress needs some accomplishments in order to restore voters' faith in the institution. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Hastert is known on Capitol Hill as a behind-the-scenes facilitator, friendly to business and the conservative agenda. He is respected as someone who is willing to reach out to members of both parties. And after a Congress known mostly for investigating presidential scandals, he says it's time to get things done.
One of the things that we feel very strongly about is that this Congress has to go to work. We have to start to produce good things that the American people want, the policies that address the needs of the American people. And that's our first and most important step in restoring America's faith in this U.S. House of Representatives.
Hastert says his goals include reforming Social Security and Medicare, cutting taxes, and strengthening education and the military. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Business slowed for the nation's factories last month. The National Association of Purchasing Management said its monthly index of business activity fell 1.7% in December. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation for coverage of health.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Borman, directed the new film The General, based on the life of the notorious Irish thief and gangster Martin Cahill. Cahill stole about $60 million in a series of ingenious robberies he masterminded in the 1980s. He worked his way up from petty crimes to stealing Vermeer paintings and precious jewels. Despite being the most wanted man in Ireland, Cahill managed to elude the police while thumbing his nose at them. Later we'll meet John Voight, who plays the police inspector determined to capture Cahill. John Borman has directed many other films, including Deliverance, Point Blank, Hope and Glory, Excalibur, The Emerald Forest, and Beyond Rangoon. The General was shot on location in Dublin. Here's a scene in which Cahill, played by Brendan Gleeson, goes to see Inspector Kenny, played by John Voight. Cahill knows that while they're talking, his men are robbing a nearby bank. The inspector is skeptical of the motivation behind Cahill's visit.
Come to confess a few crimes?
Just want to welcome you back to the neighborhood, Inspector. It's nice and peaceful now, isn't it?
You know why they sent me here, don't you?
Not because of me, I hope.
Yes, because of you. Because they think I know your wiles and your ways. And I do. It can only end one way, Martin. You keep on like this.
No.
I'm a poor fella. Haven't much. That's up to here. But I can sleep at night.
Yeah, I've seen you outside me flat there a few times.
Oh.
No. You should drop in the next time you're passing. You know? Have an old jar.
Bank robbery. Across the street.
Come on. The Celtic Bank. Come on, hurry up.
Disgrace for the profits these banks are making.
Bank.
The right bollocks out of me. Congratulations.
One of Martin Cahill's burglary victims in the 1980s was director John Borman. Borman told me what happened.
He stole, he had rather good taste. I mean, he took some very fine silver and also a little Georgian table. Then I had a gold record which had been given me for the music of Deliverance, dueling banjos. And he took that, obviously thinking that it was solid gold. He obviously didn't know much about record companies. And so, as you may have noticed, I put that scene into the movie.
Yes, and in the movie he breaks the gold record in half and says, see, it's not really gold.
Yeah, he's disgusted with it. It confirms his view of the world that everything is fake and that half the population are criminals.
Now, I think one of the eeriest scenes in the movie is early on during that cat burglar phase when he's breaking into people's homes. And it's as if he's a ghost walking through people's homes while they're there, while they're awake, some of them while they're sleeping, and no one notices that he's there.
Yes, he had this great reputation as a creeper. And he had an enormous will. He was able to, if he was found himself in a house and someone was stirred, he could stand in the shadows or in a closet for hours on end without moving a muscle. And he, you know, even in later years when he became, the general organizing these great heists, he he still, as a hobby, would go out at night and break into people's houses, usually just to raid the refrigerator. Because I think this was the beginning, you know, hark back to the origins of his career as a thief, that he used to rob food, break into houses and shops, stores, and rob food for his fatherless family. And that was a pattern he never broke.
Why did you want to make a movie about Cahill?
Well, because, first of all, he was such a fascinating character. I mean, and the contrast in his personality were extraordinary. I mean, he was called the General because of his meticulous military planning that he did with these robberies. And seldom do you find, with that sort of mind, a kind of clown to go with it. And he had this wit and humour and this sardonic humour. And he was brutal and tender, and he was a loving father and a husband to two sisters. I mean, he lived with two sisters, had four children with each of them, and they lived apparently harmoniously. It was so intriguing. But beyond that, he represented something more for me because, you know, I've always felt I've been living in Ireland for 30 years. I'm not Irish, really, but it's a spiritual home to me, and I've always felt that beneath the Christianity, that Ireland is still fundamentally a kind of pagan place, because the church is a kind of has been kind of a colonial power which has been repressive, really. And of course, the British occupation as well. So and from time to time, this kind of archetype erupts from the racial unconscious, and this kind of rebels appear, and they are anarchists. They're opposed to all of society, and they are. Eventually, you know, in order to prove their credentials as a rebel, they manage to get themselves killed. I mean, Michael Collins, for instance, was a very similar figure. The planning, the wit, the humour, the ruthlessness. So this figure is very important. And the figure of the rebel in Irish life is very important. And so for me, this Cahill's life somehow illuminates the society that he comes from because of the way that he opposes it.
Why were there frictions between Cahill and the IRA?
You see, he was opposed to all authority, really. And so far as he was concerned, the IRA was another institution with another set of rules. And he kind of just despised them. It was complicated, really, because they were always trying to get a share of his loot. They were always trying to control. I mean, their methods were to control the population, particularly at the lowest level, you know, which is where he came from, by protection and by controlling, like, you know, punishing drug dealers with kneecapping and that sort of thing. And he resented their intrusion into what he thought was his territory. And now there were, he had, you know, there were a couple of occasions where actually they kidnapped a couple of his men and he paid ransoms to the IRA. So, you know, he was pragmatic about it, but they were incensed when he began to have dealings with the Protestant terrorist groups because when he was trying to fence these paintings. And that, I think, was what really got up their nose. And, of course, they eventually shot him. On the last day of the ceasefire in 1994, so it was obviously very important to them to kill him while they still, as it were, had a license to kill. And I had obviously to be quite careful when I was making this film because, you know, for legal reasons and libel. And I imply in the film that there was collusion between the police and the IRA in the killing of Cahill, because this he was under 24-hour surveillance with police surrounding his house. There were 90 men on this task. And on this particular morning, you know, there was no police there at all. And he and his wife assumed that they'd given up finally. And so he went out to his car, and suddenly the assassin ran at him and shot him in his car. So I made a lot of investigation and research into what was behind it, and I became convinced that there was collusion.
My guest is director John Borman. His new film is called The General. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Borman. His films include Deliverance, Point Blank, and Hope and Glory. His new film is called The General. You've been living in Ireland for about 30 years. You grew up in England, lived, I think, in America on the West Coast for a while. Why did you move to Ireland?
Well, when I went to America from England, it was immensely liberating. And it made me realize just how sort of narrow and negative so much of English life was, and how class conscious it was. And there in America, everything was so positive and possible. And I enjoyed that exhilaration. And then I somehow reached a point where I just didn't want to bring my children up in Los Angeles. And so I fled. I mean, I've always been in love with America, but I never really wanted to get married, if you know what I mean. And so I was shooting a film in Ireland, I was shooting part of a film in Ireland when I was, and I fell in love with this landscape of the Wicklow Mountains and the people and the spirit of the place. And so it became a refuge for me, and bought a house there, and not really intending to stay. And I've been living in that same house for the last 30 years.
Before you started making movies, you worked in television in England, and among your assignments there was doing documentaries. I was reading that one of the documentaries you did had quite an effect on the young woman who was the subject of the film. What I read was that she had been rebelling against family and religion, and she was so uncomfortable with the notoriety that was caused by the documentary that she kind of took hiding at your house with your family. What was the story behind that?
Well, I started making a number of documentaries. This was in the early 60s, about people. And the society was rapidly changing. I mean, it was the Beatles era. And I think what had occurred, which hadn't really been recognized, was that just, you know, after 1947, when the Education Act set up these secondary modern schools, that really radically changed the way in which people were educated. And and you know, music and drama were introduced into the schools, and suddenly you got people who were growing up with a completely different kind of sensibility, and that was the kind of thing that produced the Beatles and all that, and the swinging London and all of that, and this was the early stages of it, and I went around and found people who were changing in different ways, and made films about them. Now, and the films were immensely successful and caused tremendous stir, because in a sense people were suddenly confronted with these people who they didn't realize existed. It was like a new breed of people was emerging, and so there was great kind of excitement about it. And this was a girl who was at school, a 16-year-old girl who she was adopted by a Salvation Army family, and she was very radical in her ideas, and her coming from a very severe and religious background, And it did, the notoriety was had a you know, devastating effect on her. And in fact, she came to live with me and my wife because she was she needed refuge. And that's when I started. That's when I felt that there was something wrong about making documentaries of that nature, because the people involved were made very vulnerable by it. And so that I started to dramatize. I started to make fiction.
Do you still feel that way about documentaries?
Well, so that kind of documentary that is, yes, I do. I think it's dangerous, and it does endanger people. But I mean, I just made a documentary, as a matter of fact, myself, but it was a much different kind of one about Lee Marvin.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd like to ask you about Lee Marvin, but first I just want to get back to this theme of people changing in that kind of early Beatles era. Your first feature film was the 1965 film Catch Us If You Can, which is known in America as Having a Wild Weekend, which starred the Dave Clark Five, which is one of the big British invasion groups here in America. Was that seen as being connected to the documentary subjects that you were doing?
Very much so. And in fact, the film is full of characters who are drawn from my documentaries. And Peter Nichols and I, who wrote the script, we wove together various aspects of the films I'd made for the BBC. And so it was very much about that era. And it was a very pessimistic film, really. And about the way in which this youth explosion and rebellion was fundamentally going to be thwarted by society, which turned out to be the case.
Well, let's get to Lee Marvin. You made the 1967 film Point Blank that he starred in. How did you first meet him? And I guess more importantly, what is his importance to your career and your work and your thoughts on filmmaking?
Oh, tremendously. I just made this documentary about him, and which was really, in a sense, a study of our relationship and on these two films that we made together. And when I first met him,
the second was Hell in the Pacific.
Yes. When I first met him, he was shooting The Dirty Dozen in London, and a producer gave me a script and gave it to him too, and we met. And Lee said, "What do you think of this script?" I said, "It's absolutely terrible." And he said, "Well, I agree. So what are we talking about?" I said, "Well, the character is fascinating." And it was from a book by Donald Westlake. And so we met a number of times and talked. And I began to get a picture of Marvin. I'd always been kind of fascinated by him, by this his kind of violence. And when I talked, I began to understand how important his war experience had been, where he'd been ambushed and wounded in Saipan. He'd been involved in a number of battles that had killed a lot of Japanese, and that he had been brutalized. He was a young boy, 17, and he'd been brutalized by this war experience, and somehow he was in his violent roles that he played, he was somehow replaying these experiences or trying to exorcise the experience. And so Point Blank became, in a way, a story of Lee Marvin. It was a film about him, and that's what gave it its great resonance, I think.
Lee Marvin strikes me as a very American kind of actor, in the sense that the stereotype of the British actor is of the actor who's classically trained, and the stereotype of the American actor is the actor who isn't necessarily trained but has great intuition about acting. And although I don't know much about Lee Marvin's background, I would imagine he fits into that American stereotype of being the intuitive actor.
Oddly enough, that's not the case. I mean, he's full of contradictions, really, because he played a lot of classical theater in New York in his beginning of his career.
No, that surprises me, because I just always think of him as the tough guy.
That's right. Well, he was much more than that. But he did have a tremendous controlling intelligence, and at the same time, he had these darker instincts, which were always, the two things were always in conflict and very often in balance when he was working at his best.
Now, in the movie Hill in the Pacific, you directed Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune, and Mifune is most famous for the films that he made with the Japanese director Kurosawa. Mifune, in his own way, is a very broad actor, almost hammy by American standards, and in that sense, just the opposite of Lee Marvin. And I'm wondering what it was like to work with both of them in the same film.
It was a nightmare. I mean, it was, you know, Kurosawa said, you know, you can't direct Mifune, you can only point him in a direction. And it was, I mean, he was like a force of nature. And with all that kind of explosive, over-the-top kind of emotion. And so my role was like a fireman. I was always squirting a hose at him to try and keep him down, you know, and struggling with him to get him to do what I wanted, and it took so much time to get the performance I wanted. And by the time I'd get Mifune into shape, Lee Marvin was down the other end of a beach, you know, drunk, and it was a total nightmare.
Did they get along with each other?
They loved each other. They loved each other. They were absolutely, you know, and I mentioned that Point Blank was a kind of journey for Lee, Hell in the Pacific was even more so, because we were going back to revisit the Second World War, and here he was making a film with the Japanese that he'd fought against. So it was... there were all sorts of levels going on there, and it was pretty hard to handle.
Film director John Borman. His new movie is called The General. Borman will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Voight talks about his new movie, The General, and his breakthrough film, Midnight Cowboy. And we continue our talk with the director of The General, John Borman.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with director John Borman. His new movie, The General, is based on the story of the notorious Irish gangster Martin Cahill. Borman's other films include Deliverance, Point Blank, Excalibur, The Emerald Forest, and Hope and Glory. You directed the film Deliverance, based on the James Dickey novel. And of course, you know, the most famous scene in that movie is the scene in which the Ned Beatty character is raped by one of the people who they meet on this canoe trip that they're taking. I recently talked to James Dickey's son, Christopher Dickey, who wrote a memoir about his father. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it or not. But, you know, he writes in that memoir that he felt kind of traumatized during the making of the film because he was the stand-in for Ned Beatty during the shooting of the rape scene. So while they were setting up the lighting and stuff like that, it was Christopher Dickey who was playing the part. Did you realize that he was upset by being the stand-in in that role?
I think he's romanticizing a little bit. He was you know, working as a stand-in, and a stand-in just simply stands there while you put the lights on him. It doesn't rehearse, or doesn't play the scene in any way. He's just standing around there while to give the actor, so the actor doesn't have to stand there while the lighting's going on. So I read the excerpt in the New Yorker, and I think he writes very, very well. And of course he and most of what he said there was quite accurate. His father, I mean, he did have a very difficult relationship with his father. And Dickey, you know, who I admired enormously, and he was also a very, very difficult man, and he drank a lot. And when we were rehearsing before we started shooting the picture, and the rehearsal period, the four actors got very upset about him because he was very overbearing, and he would only address them as by the characters they were playing. And Jim Dickey, you know, when I first met him, he said to me, "I'm going to tell you something I never told a living soul." He said, "Everything in that book happened to me," and I was absolutely shocked, you know, by this. But then of course I began to realize he was telling everybody this story, and it was patently, you know. And I said to Jim at one point, I said, "You know, I'm much more impressed that you could have imagined and invented all this than if it happened to you." You know, he lived on the edges of reality in some respects. And finally, I had to tell him to leave because his presence was becoming really a problem. And eventually, so he said, "All right, I'll go, but I want to say goodbye to the boys." So we went down to where we were rehearsing, and he came in and he drew himself up and he said, "It appears that my presence would be most efficacious by its absence." And he turned on his heel and he left. And Bert Reynolds said to me, "Does that mean he's going or he's staying?"
So did things go smoother after he left?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then he came back to play the sheriff, which he did very well.
Right. You've written that you had to get completion insurance for the new movie, The General, which required your getting a physical. Why don't you just briefly explain what completion insurance is?
Well, you know, insurance company insures the film to complete it. In other words, if for any reason, say, one of the lead actors dies or is incapacitated and can't complete the film, you know, you either recast it and start again or you abandon the film, in which case the insurance company has to pay up. And it's a big deal. So they want to make sure that you're not going to die when you're in the course of making the film. So I had to do one of these medicals, and I did this treadmill test, and they said, "Oh, you've got a heart disease." And
So what did you do when they told you that? Did you decide, well, the heck with this movie?
They said, "You've got to go in the hospital and have an angiogram right away, and, you know, you could drop dead at any moment." And so I said, "Well, I can't possibly do that. I'm making a film, you know, which is much more important than life and death." And so I went through and I completed the film, being careful not to run up the stairs and things like that. Cut down on my intake of animal fats. And then at the end of the film, I went, you know, and had an angiogram. And it was completely a false alarm, you know, and I had this angiogram, and the specialist said, well, you know, he said, not only do you not have heart disease, he said, you'll never have heart disease. He said, you know, your arteries and your valves and everything are in perfect condition. You'll die of something else, he said. Of course, he said, probably something much more painful. A heart attack, you know, it's not a bad way of going.
Oh, gosh. Do you think that what you thought might be a death sentence hanging over your head affected how you made the general?
I hope not. Curiously, it was, you know, it's just a little nagging doubt I had in my mind all the time, because generally speaking, it was a real pleasure making the film. It was a, you know, there was also the fear that the criminals might take action against me in some way, or the IRA, so my life was kind of, I felt my life was on the line, and in a sense, that's not a bad way to feel, because isn't that after all the reality?
Do you feel that way now?
Well, yes. I mean, that in a sense, one's life is on the line. You know, I mean, I'm 65 years old. You know, death is rapidly approaching. And I have to face it with the same kind of endurance and courage that I've used in making films.
John Boorman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
John Boorman. His new movie is called The General. Coming up, we'll meet one of the film's stars, John Voight. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Voight, is one of the stars of John Boorman's new film, The General. Voight and Boorman go back a long way. Voight co-starred in Boorman's 1972 film, Deliverance. It was Voight's leading role in the 1969 film, Midnight Cowboy, that first made him a star. He played a small-town guy who quits his dishwashing job to make it in New York, where he becomes a small-time stud. Here's a scene early in the film. He's just told a fellow dishwasher he's leaving.
What are you gonna do back east?
There's a lot of rich women back there, Ralph. Begging for it, paying for it, too.
Yeah?
Yeah, hell yeah. And the men, they're mostly tutti-frutties.
Oh, I bet you're some mess back there.
So I'm gonna cash in on some of that, right?
I don't know. I don't know nothing about it.
Hell, what do I got to stay around here for? I got places to go, right?
John Voight won an Academy Award in 1979 for his role as a paraplegic Vietnam veteran in Coming Home. His recent films include Mission Impossible and The Rainmaker. You can see him now in Enemy of the State. In The General, Voight plays Ned Kenny, the police inspector determined to capture the elusive thief Martin Cahill, the most wanted man in Ireland. In this scene, Cahill, played by Brendan Gleeson, accuses the inspector of losing his moral center.
You're getting to be like me. Trespass, harassment, intimidation, beating people up. You've had to come down to my level.
That's right, Martin. You brought me down with you. I'm in the gutter as well.
John Voight's character is a composite of several Irish police inspectors. One of them, Gerry O'Carroll, became Voight's mentor for the film.
This guy, Gerry, when we went on our little rounds, as actors do, and I certainly do, he took me into many strange places. One place was this interrogation aspect of his work. And he would open the door into this interrogation room, and there would be a fellow sitting there. And Gerry, who would be saying, John, no, wait, John, stay here. I'll go in and see. I'll check it out. I know this fellow. I'll go and talk to him a bit. Then I'll bring you in. stuff like that, you see. And then he would go in, and I would hear him shouting, and then he'd tell me to come in the room. He'd say, and he introduced me as the inspector from another part of Ireland. He would say, so you see this man here? You see this man? He's come all the way down from Kerry to see you. What do you think, inspector? And he'd throw it at me, and I'd say, I don't want anything to do with it now. And I'd leave the room or whatever I'd say, you know. But he was amazing. I can't really, you know, he used a lot of, vulgarity, I suppose you would say, a little swearing and stuff like that, although it was very charming and very rich in flavor. But when he went into this room, he would turn into this other personality, you know. And then when he come out of this particular place, he said to me, he's a real villain, you know, John. This fella's a real villain. He knows me, I know him. This isn't going to do any good to him. Not going to break this fella. Back in the streets, you know, doing his, plying his trade.
So when you were in the interrogation room with him, you had to not only pretend you were someone else, you had to fake an accent.
Yeah, well, my accent, I mean, I'm pretty far away from the time I did the film, so my accent will be somewhere, Icelandic or something, you know, halfway between America and Ireland now. But when I was there, I was really a student of the accent, and I did a very good study of it, and I think I produced a pretty authentic accent, actually. But I'm fairly good with accents, so I didn't have discomfort in attempting it. But as I, when I got there, I realized that the accent from these fellows who are the detectives, the accents come from other parts of the country. All the other players were going to play Dublin accents. But the interesting thing was that I was going to play this fellow who was from Kerry, let's say. And these other fellows were playing Dublin accents, were using Dublin accents. But some of them were coming from other parts of Ireland, and they had to relearn their accent. So I wasn't the only fellow that had to do an accent in the piece that was unfamiliar.
You're in a bunch of new films now. Before Mission Impossible, you seem to have been not doing a lot in terms of movies. And I'm wondering what was happening in your life during that period when you weren't making a lot of theatrical films.
Well, quite a lot was going on, actually. I'm a person who is, I'm a humanitarian. I have been involved for much of my adult life in many causes. And during that time, I made several films. I turned down a lot of pieces, theatrical pieces, and I did some pieces that had to do with certain causes that I felt strongly about. One I did for TNT, which was about Chernobyl. I did a piece about the Rainbow Warrior, which is the Greenpeace ship that was protesting nuclear testing in the Pacific. I was very, very busy, and then I came to a period when my mom was quite ill, and her boys wanted to be around her continuously. My two brothers and myself arranged our schedules to, you know, spend time with her, and spell each other in that process, and design things so that she would look forward to different events for her life. And in the process of that, toward the end of that period, I was looking for a little trip to take with my mom because she loved to go on to film sets. So I said, well, now I've got to get a big film. So I said, well, what would be exotic enough for her to get excited about? And all of a sudden, I was offered this part with Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. And I was able to come back to my mother and say, Mom, guess what? We're going to go to Czechoslovakia, and then we're going to go to London. We're going to spend a couple of weeks in each place in March. John, that's great. So she was a very interesting gal who had just a very admirable personality. She was a very strong gal, and she had determined that she wasn't going to take any radiation. She would take a little chemotherapy.
She had cancer?
She had cancer, and... She had a bad an arm that was giving her a lot of pain. She had bone cancer toward the end, and her arm was giving her a lot of pain. And she found that she had a little radiation that the pain would go away for some time. She knew it was not doing anything positive for her arm in the long run, but she was very pragmatic, and she said, "Well, I'll go into the hospital. Give me 2 weeks' notice, and I'll go get the radiation. And 2 weeks later, I'll be pain free, and I'll be able to jump around with you." And that's the way she was. She was jumping around with me in Czechoslovakia and London. I mean, she came over and she had a wonderful, wonderful time. So then I was in the, I was back into it again. And then she said, well, what's next? And then I had to come up with a couple of other offers, which I did. And then I was on the way. And then she passed on and I was back at work. And that's what she wanted anyway. So I think I'm probably following her encouragement.
Do you think your mother led you back into it?
Yeah, I think in some way she did.
You've physically changed a bit since you started in movies, and I'm wondering if you think your physical type is different, and of course your age is different, and how the roles you get now compared to the ones you got early in your career.
I was always a character actor, Terry, so, and it was always a little difficult for people to pin me down. I've had my moments when I was a romantic lead, but they were very brief. Coming Home was one of them. But as I say, I was always a character actor, always looking to change the way I walked and talked, and looking at each character as a totally different portrait from anything prior. And I'm still in that mode. I have a little more, you know, I have different paints to work with. I look in the mirror and I've changed, and I now have, with maturity, have a little more weight, I suppose. And as a personality, you have more weight, and you can do other things.
Well, let's go back to John Voight, the early years. Your first big break as an actor was getting cast in the Broadway production of Sound of Music, where you got to play the character of Ralph, the young man who sings 16 Going on 17.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Was that what you saw for yourself, being a star in Broadway musicals?
No, I didn't actually see that. I had a very funny experience with that. When I went into audition for Richard Rodgers, I had come down to the audition in a rainstorm on a bicycle, on a motorbike, with this fellow who was my manager and played the piano for me. And the only reason I had him as a manager is because I couldn't get another manager. This guy wanted to be my manager, and he was he managed musical talents. So the only things he ever auditioned me for were musicals. But I wasn't much of a singer. Matter of fact, I think I was I couldn't really think of myself as getting any of these jobs. And I went on stage, and I just happened to have this little, maybe it was a cold coming on from the rain or whatever it is, but my voice was a little deeper, and I was able to get through this little melody, which the boy had to sing. And as we came out after the audition, I was used to saying thank you very quickly and saving my dignity and walking off the stage before they said thank you, do you know? And I got to the stage door, and my manager, this fellow Ron, came running out, and he said, they like you. They want you to do the part. And I looked at him in shock, and I said, they want me to do the part? You get in there and you tell those people I can't sing. That was my response. He said, I can't tell them. Richard Rodgers was out there. Oh, boy, what are we going to do? I didn't know what to do. So I got the part, and I thought, because I had gotten the part and because nobody said what a terrible singer, that I was doing all right. And then I heard a recording back once after a matinee, and it was just as bad as I thought it was. And I tried to desperately, stay on the notes after that without using every technique and concentration I could.
You still remember your big song?
I still remember it, Terry, but I ain't going to sing it.
Right.
Forget it.
Okay, forgotten. So were you on the original cast? You're not on the cast recording.
No, I was the first replacement. I replaced the fellow by the name of Brian Davies.
Oh, so did you get to know Richard Rodgers?
Not well. I met him, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I married the young lady I played opposite, Laurie Peters, wonderful actress.
Oh, you're kidding. Mm-hmm. So at your wedding, you could have sung
the
duet.
But we still are friends. It was cute. You know, we had a nice marriage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Voight, and he plays the detective in the new film, The General, which is based on the true story of kind of infamous Irish crime boss, I guess you could say, named Martin Cahill. And the film's called The General. We'll take a short break here and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Voight, and his new movie is called The General. John Voight, in 1969, you starred in Midnight Cowboy, playing a dishwasher from Texas who comes to New York and tries to make it as a hustler, coming on to lonely but affluent middle-aged women. How did you get the part?
You know what I like about this? The description is so nicely formed, and that's actually what it's about, of course. But but it's so funny, you know, because, I don't know, I mean, when you look at the film and you remember, a lot of women up there, lonely women, you know, waiting for it, just praying for it, too. So, you know, it's a real mess up there. It must be a real mess up there. Well, I'm going to get me some of that stuff, Ralph. You know, whatever it was in the movie. It's just amusing.
How did you get the part of Joe Buck? I read that you were turned down for it several times, but you kept coming back, insisting you should have it.
Yeah, I've been a person who didn't really ever... before that, concern myself if I was turned down for a role. I mean, you have to, as an actor, boy, you have to have a lot of, you have to have a little bit of calluses on your psyche in order that you don't get hurt continuously from the rejections, because you're being rejected continuously. But for me, I would always take it more philosophically. And say, well, if it's not me, then the other guy's got this hard work to do to produce this, you know, effort. And I would give him all the encouragement in the world. Sometimes I would even say, well, I think there's a better fellow. I met this guy, or Robert Redford would be real good for this part, or something like that. You know, I wasn't shy about suggesting other people, even in the face of people wanting me sometimes. But anyway, in this case, it was unique. I read the book, and I had really fallen in love with this character, and I felt very strongly about the way to approach it. And when it was not given to me, finally, after long deliberations, looking at screen tests and stuff like this, they had it down to two people, myself and another fellow, and they went the other way, because the other fellow had just done a picture for Universal, and he was a little more of a known entity. And I tried to, you know, take this blow philosophically as well, but I found myself walking around the city, New York City, where I was living at the time, and just I had a knot in my stomach I couldn't get rid of. I just felt terrible. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then finally, I received a call from my agent saying, don't give up hope. Something's happening. Something's stirring here, and it might come back to you. And indeed it did. So I was saved from a tremendous ulcer at a young age.
So who was the actor who was supposed to get it?
I actually don't like to mention names because it's, you know,
won't be helping them.
wasn't a happy moment for him, and right. Why should I? He's a tremendous actor, so let him be.
Right. So here you are in your film breakthrough, playing opposite Dustin Hoffman, who this was after The Graduate, I guess. So he had already started to make a name for himself. So it must have been fun to work together.
Yes, because I'd known Dusty. I'd done a piece called A View from the Bridge in New York with a director whose name was Ulu Grossbard. And Ulu is a tremendous director. He's done some films and done some stage work that's been very admirable. And he was very close friends with Dusty. And Dusty used to show up, and he was a little bit of an assistant to the director. He would just throw his comments in, and I remember some of them. His thoughts were always unique, always based on authentic circumstances, very unusual ideas. Like there's a point where the neighborhood, and we're doing this in a little theater, very, very tiny little place, and he had guys throwing fruit from the light booth to make it more realistic that the neighborhood was upset, you know, throwing garbage out the windows. But anyway, so I had known Dusty, and Dusty actually was very generous with me specifically. After the first rehearsal of A View from the Bridge, which had many wonderful actors, among them was Bobby Duvall, prominent among them was Robert Duvall, and he was great in the piece. And I was the second lead, really. And Dusty came up to me at one point and said to me very quietly, as was Dusty's way, as is Dusty's way, he says, "You're going to be very good in this," he said to me. And I said, "Wow, thanks, Dustin." And so a couple of years later, there I was with Dustin Hoffman doing a screen test for Midnight Cowboy. So we knew each other. And I had never seen him act, but I'd heard so many great things about him. You know, the word was out, you know, on actors before anybody ever knew them, before they got the roles to exhibit their potential. People like Gene Hackman, Bobby Duvall, Dustin Hoffman were all being talked about before they came to the fore. Al Pacino, Bobby De Niro. You know, I heard about these guys at different moments. Bobby De Niro's done some great work at the studio, man. Stuff like that, you know. So.
Well, John Voight, a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. Pleasure to talk to you, too.
John Voight stars in the new film, The General. You can also see him in Enemy of the State. His film Varsity Blues opens soon, and he plays Noah in a forthcoming miniseries called Noah's Ark. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Peter Guralnick's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Dean Olsher. Join me on the next Fresh Air for a conversation with writer Richard Ford, who's edited a new collection of Chekhov's short stories. And I'll speak with Arnold Steinhardt. His memoir, Indivisible by Four, is about his 35 years with the Guarneri String Quartet. Join us for the next Fresh Air.